Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I'm Greg Gutfeld.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm Brett Baer, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. It might be a contentious political issue right now for the president, but will the conflict in the Middle East be in 3 or 6 months from now as the presidential race ramps up?
They just need to get in a position where they are improving their poll numbers more, because if the election was held today, they would likely lose.
I'm Dana Perino. Your 20s can be a tough decade, especially in uncertain times. But there is hope for young adults trying to start their lives.
In general, we know that life gets better as you go. If your 20s turn out to be the best years of your life, something has gone wrong. Life should get better.
And I'm former U.S. Senator Scott Brown. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Last week, after days of not addressing it, President Biden did address the campus protests. He said they were putting two things to the test, the right to free speech and the rule of law. Peaceful protests are how Americans respond, he said, to controversial issues. But he said violent protests are not protected.
Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law.
He said dissent shouldn't lead to other students' inability to finish their education, their classes, to get a degree and just even walk across campus. The reaction was swift. Republicans like Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton called the campus protests Little Gazas.
President Biden needs to denounce Hamas's campus sympathizers without equivocating about Israelis fighting a righteous war of survival.
Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said on CNN's Christiane Amanpour's show last Thursday,
I am thinking back, and other people are making this reference, that this may be Biden's Vietnam.
President's campaign co-chair and former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu said that is a big exaggeration. More recent polling, though, has shown U.S. support for Israel dropping. A poll in late March found a majority disapproved of Israel's actions in Gaza. As President Biden criticizes certain military actions in Gaza, administration officials continue to say Israel has the right to defend itself. At the end of his remarks last week, he was asked,
Mr. President, have the protest forced you to reconsider any of the policies with regard to the region?
No.
But even if political calculations aren't being made right now, they could be at a later date.
Well, most people don't vote based on foreign policy.
Daniel Lippman is the White House and Washington, D.C. reporter for Politico.
And so if you look at young people, Gaza is number 15 on their issue priority list. And so sometimes what happens in Ivy League colleges and elite institutions, that can make it seem like every young person is mad about this issue when if the polls do not indicate that. But a vocal minority are very concerned. And so I still think at the end of the day, it's how people feel about the economy and whether they think that Donald Trump and his presidency, they want to return to that, or do they think he could be a felon in a few weeks from New York? Do they not? Are they worried about chaos resulting if he comes back into power? And also Biden's age question. He has never fully addressed that, and it's hard to address it. And so
I think you address it just by living, right? it is what it is.
You know, he reassured a lot of people with the State of the Union, but that was weeks ago. And I think a lot of Americans who are undecided in those few swing states, they're waiting for the debates to make up their mind and whether Biden seems presidential and can and how out there Trump seems.
You know, Congressman Ro Khanna has said that the president should maybe visit some of these campus protests. Given what you just said, that this might be sort of, you know, just the more of a vocal minority, and given what we know about what the president travels to, what's on his priority list, you know, is that likely, or is it more likely that we're going to kind of leave it at last week's statement, you know, where violence isn't acceptable. I mean, unless things ramp back up or change in a big way.
I think President Biden is very happy that the summer has is approaching because now he doesn't have to worry as much about college students on campuses protesting him. And if this ceasefire can take hold, then he can point to this and say, hey, this was my CIA director making these tough negotiations happen, protecting lives, keeping Israel secure, and helping the Palestinians. And so that is going to be his strategy. And he can also tell young people, if you care about Palestinians, then Donald Trump would be worse for them. And so why would you reward Donald Trump to be a stronger ally of Israel and not someone who really supports the Palestinian cause very much?
All right. Now, finally, Daniel, Politico reported that a lot of these anti-Israel college protesters are funded by the Tides Foundation, which gets money from Soros, and that Tides has given money to Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now, and those are two anti-Israel groups, but also that money's coming from David Rockefeller Jr. and Susan and Nick Pritzker. These are people who back President Biden, right? So are we going to see some sort of pressure there financially, or any sort of divide from that, or was this, you know, this is not surprising?
It was a really good story, but I don't think it's terribly shocking that liberal causes sometimes support progressive pro-Palestinian groups. And I think the biggest issue right now I see is the divide in terms of the Biden campaign is doing much better financially compared to Trump and doing raising more money. And that's going to have an impact in terms of setting up those field offices in swing states, making sure people are motivated to go to the polls, hiring volunteers who are, you know, making sure that they have enough stuff in terms of literature, and TV ads are so important. And so the Biden campaign feels like they are doing well on that. They just need to get in a position where they are improving their poll numbers more, because if the election was held today, they would likely lose.
When it comes to anti-Israel protesters, some of them are playing the long game, with reports of different groups applying for permits to protest at the DNC in Chicago in August.
I think Biden and the Democrats really hope that by August, things are not where they are right now.
Carly Cooperman is a Democratic pollster and CEO of Schoen Cooperman Research.
There is a divide in the Democratic Party that we've seen play out over the course of the Israel-Hamas conflict. And Biden is trying to strike this balance between acknowledging the humanitarian crisis that's taking place and also being a steadfast supporter for Israel as our Democratic ally in the Middle East. He has made young voters, young Democrats, unhappy with his position. But I think, you know, as the leader of the United States, he has no choice but to take that position. And now it's just manifesting in another version with the protests that are taking place on college campuses, because it's the same idea where, you know, he's got to acknowledge people's right to free speech and to expression and to protest peacefully, but it's not okay for violence and for chaos. And, you know, to what extent do these protests become filled with hate speech and anti-Semitic and the like? I think that by the summer, at least, you know, colleges aren't in session anymore.
Well, they'll be going back at that time in August.
That is true. I think the hope is that things are in a different place then. But there's definitely concern as it relates to Chicago. And I think they're going to take a hard look at what the Democratic convention looks like if things are as they are now.
Carly, young people don't approve of the president's handling of the conflict by wider margins than other age groups, right? And we saw also out of Michigan's Democratic primary, the uncommitted vote got more than 100,000 votes rather than those votes going to President Biden. We know that that was probably a protest vote. It's an obvious swing state, though. So how big, you know, given what we know, how big of a political issue is this for the president right now?
Right now, it's a big political issue. My gut tells me, my belief is that, you know, when you look at poll data as well, in terms of the issues that are most important to voters when they think about actually voting at the end of the day, there are other issues that are going to come into play in terms of how they vote. I think there is really a faction of people you know, both in Michigan and among young voters who do not want to vote for Biden, whereas they would be expected to based on what's going on. But I also think that as the election really takes place come the fall, and it's a choice between Biden and Trump and all of the other policies and positions that come with it, I think some people come around to vote at the end of the day for Biden, or, you know, how they would. But right now, this is a big issue, and the Biden administration knows it.
When you hear people say, oh, you know, he's reacting, his calculations are political, he's worried about Michigan, you know, that's why he's saying what he's saying to about Israel, he needs to convince Michigan voters that he's not on Israel's side. You know, what do you make of that? It is one state, but it's a pretty important swing state. Like, what are the political calculations right now?
I think Biden is very aware of the political calculations, and Michigan is an important state. But I don't think he's saying what he's saying just to appease voters in Michigan. This is a much bigger problem than that. And the entire Democratic Party that he is the leader of is divided on this issue. And it just reflects the, like, the big picture conflict as it relates to, you know, acknowledging the humanitarian crisis that's happening, but then also maintaining its support for Israel, calling out the fact that Hamas has been the reason there has been no ceasefire to date, not Israel. You know, Israel has withdrawn virtually all its troops a few weeks ago, and there's so little conversation about that. It's definitely, there's a bias in terms of how this thing is being talked about. And I think Biden both is aware of the political implications, but he also, as the leader of the United States, really wants to reach a resolution and, you know, really sees both sides of this.
Finally, Carly, you know, Politico is pointing out that the groups funding the campus protesters in part our Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now, those are two anti-Israel groups getting money from the Tides Foundation, which gets money from George Soros, David Rockefeller Jr., Susan and Nick Pritzker. Those are people who back President Biden. You know, to your earlier point about, you know, the divide, is there fear that even if it's not now, the Biden campaign could end up feeling some pressure financially over any stance regarding Israel and Gaza?
Look, right now, the Biden administration is in a strong position from a financial point of view. They have a lot of money. You know, to date, the narrative has been that the Biden campaign is stronger than the Trump campaign in terms of cash, but they're weaker in terms of enthusiasm. So thankfully, I think that's one thing that doesn't have to be the biggest concern right now. But, you know, it would be unrealistic for me to say that that's never part of the equation too, as it relates to funding and big donors and the like.
All right, Carly Kuberman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. If you like mafia shows and movies, you may enjoy the money, wealth, or the power portrayed in these shows, but you're only getting one version of the story from the TV screen. This week, I sat down with the man who infiltrated the real-life Sopranos and lived to tell the tale. Former FBI agent Giovanni Rocco details his harrowing experience going undercover with the DeCavalcante crime family. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
This is former U.S. Senator Scott Brown with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Being an adult isn't easy, especially for 20-somethings. It's a transitional decade when young people are making massive life decisions about where to live, who to love, and what career path they want to take. These days, the pressure to navigate this transitional period is heightened by inflation, a rapidly evolving job market, and a general feeling of uncertainty. It's no wonder it is common for people in their 20s these days to be coping with anxiety and loneliness. Bestselling author and psychologist Dr. Meg Jay specializes in 20-somethings. She also gave a TED Talk on that topic that has been viewed over 13 million times.
Newspapers talk about the changing timetable of adulthood. Researchers call the 20s an extended adolescence. Journalists coined silly nicknames for 20-somethings like Twixters and Cadults. It's true. As a culture, we have trivialized what is actually the defining decade of adulthood.
Meg Jay has been offering help and advice to this misunderstood group of young adults for over two decades.
Well, I was a 20-something once myself, so I learned not just from working with 20-somethings for 25 years, but also from being one.
Meg Jay's latest book is The 20-Something Treatment, A Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age.
I think it's important for 20-somethings to hear this is really common and that you don't necessarily need to panic when these aren't turning out to be the best years of your life.
In one of the stories that you tell, a young man goes through a breakup and he's depressed. And you write about how sometimes now people in their 20s, because you can go on Google right away or Reddit and self-diagnose, you think, oh my gosh, I'm never going to get better and I have to go on medication. But you say something to him about, you know, in 3 months, you're going to get better.
Yeah, that the number one precursor to depression in young adults is a breakup. So oftentimes young adults will come into my office, they'll say, oh no, I'm clinically depressed. And I'll say, well, what's going on? And usually they've had a significant loss. Usually it's a breakup. But I think it's really helpful for young adults to understand you're grieving. This is normal. This means you let yourself care. You let yourself love someone. It's healthy to be upset about it. That means your heart is working. Your attachment system is working. It does not mean you have a mental health disorder or that you'll never get better or that you need medication.
So your other book is The Defining Decade, which I recommend to every graduate and their parents.
Thank
and it's about
you.
How you have to really put in the time and effort in your 20s because then the rest of your life gets better. And I've known that that's been true certainly for me as well. I remember writing in Everything Will Be Okay that my hope for everybody was that they wouldn't worry their young life away.
Right.
That everything eventually would be okay, but that I did work very hard in my 20s.
Right.
What I thought was very interesting in reading your book and knowing both of them is that from the defining decade to the 20-something treatment, enough time passed that there were some big differences in new material that you could use. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the 20-something treatment is really about young adult mental health and doing this for 25 years, I have been talking about young adult mental health, but mostly behind closed doors because culturally it wasn't a conversation we were having. Now, everybody's talking about mental health. I've been in a way, the message with mental health is similar, that mental health tends to get better across the lifespan from 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. But you've got to put the work in your 20s. And that means, you know, learning skills and not just looking for answers with pills.
So you talk about, and I love the first part of it, something called the nocebo effect.
Yes.
And I thought I would give you a chance to explain, what does that mean? It's not a placebo, it's a nocebo.
The nocebo effect is the power of negative expectations. So oftentimes what happens with young adults is life will be difficult. They're feeling depressed or anxious. They'll go online. They'll see that they very easily meet the criteria for some mental health disorder or another. And then they come into my office and they say, oh no, I have a mental health disorder. I'm going to have this for the rest of my life. I'm going to be anxious forever. I'm going to be depressed forever. And so that's the power of negative expectations, is that they feel like this is abnormal. We can all look back on our 20s and most of us would probably say, that was a mental health low point, and my life has gotten better. And I think 20-somethings need to be hearing that more rather than labeling themselves for life.
What do you think is the scope and scale of the mental health problem for 20-somethings today?
I will tell you that in the 25 years I've been doing this, that young adults have always been more likely than older adults to feel depressed, to feel anxious, to feel suicidal, and to struggle with substances. Are they feeling that way more now than 10 years ago? Maybe, although it's really difficult to untangle that from talking about it more, people relying on diagnoses more. But it's always been the decade when people were most likely to struggle.
I was taken by the passages about medication. Mm-hmm. And over prescription, and also people thinking that that will be the answer, but then it leading to other problems. Like if they give you a medication for one thing, it might lead to you not sleeping well. So you take a medication for something else, and it's hard to get off of that carousel.
I mean, I'm very clear in the 20-something treatment that for some people, medication is useful or necessary, but medication is not always the best medicine. It's not for everyone. I had a client come in the other day and say, my roommate has something and she loves it. She's doing great. And I said, well, you and your roommate don't have the same brain or the same problems. So I don't know if that's the best medicine. But most 20-somethings, when they start antidepressants, don't realize that they have downsides. So those can be weight gain, sexual dysfunction, both of which are significantly, you know, developmentally difficult for 20-somethings. Even more important, what I hear 20-somethings start to complain about once they're on the medication is the emotional numbing. So antidepressants, they make the bad days less bad, but often the good days are less good.
Do you think that social media has also exacerbated the problems that were already there?
I do. I mean, I think watching other people appear to have the best life ever is going to make you feel stressed and anxious and depressed, although you have some control over how much time you spend watching that. So, you know, I urge all my 20-something clients to give that a hard look. But I also think back to the nocebo effect that it has led 20-somethings to hear about diagnoses that they think they meet criteria for. And so it has led them to conclude that they have 3 or 4 or 5 mental health problems when actually they're having a hard time.
And I liked also learning a little bit more about the social anxiety of like even meeting new people. And I know that that's not easy.
Right.
And I write in a couple of my books of mentoring, like the idea that you have to force yourself to go to one mentoring event a month.
Right. Yes.
To me, I feel like that's like a baby step, right? But for some people, it's like, oh my gosh, how am I going to do it? What's my opening line? And
yes,
it can become so overwhelming as the first thing that you will cancel off of your schedule. What are some ways that you talk about in the book that can help young people or the parents that care about them get them to be willing to go out and meet new people?
Right. Well, one is I really try to go for a reframing of quote, social anxiety. So to give you a little background, so social anxiety disorder really is, you know, fear of worry about meeting new people, worry about being judged, how you're going to perform. 50% of young adults, quote, meet criteria for this, which means the developmental criteria, you know, are not appropriate for 20-somethings, that every 20-something feels anxious and nervous about. I was just interviewing a new client last week, and we were looking for areas where she could expand and meet new people. She's living in a new city, who's, you know, has exactly zero friends so far. She'd actually gotten up the nerve to join a walking group, which I thought was really cool. But I was asking her, well, what are other things that are important to you? What are your values? And are you political? Are you religious? Where are groups where you could join and meet other like-minded young adults? I think those are wonderful places to start.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about decision-making. It's so critical. And I loved Trey Gowdy's book. It's called Start, Stay, or Leave.
And I'll have to read it.
I think it's one of the best books about decision-making that I've ever read. And one of the things that you say is that you don't necessarily have to get all the answers right in your 20s. There's a lot of decisions that you make, but especially if you're an educated American, you can really reverse course. Like, okay, I tried to go into the insurance business. That didn't work. Let me try going into automotive parts or whatever it might be.
Right. Yes. And as a matter of fact, young adults on average are going to have 9 different jobs by the age of 35. But I remind them, this probably isn't your last job. This isn't the last time you're going to get to decide this. So you make the best decision that you can based on the information you have. And then you check in with yourself in 1 year and 2 or 2 years and you say, do I want to sign up for another year or two of this? Or mm-hmm. is it time to change course?
Right. That it's okay to experiment a little bit.
Absolutely.
I wanted to kind of end with this because whenever I'm reading a book, I'm thinking of the potential people who might love it, right? So there's a lot of different people who will listen to this podcast. And I was thinking about 3 different groups of people that would benefit from reading this. So I'll mention them and then let you talk about why you think the book is good for them.
Okay.
First of all, would be 20-somethings themselves.
Absolutely. That's who I wrote it for primarily. Yes.
And if they were to be able to take like a couple things away from this, when you imagine your reader, the 20-something reader at the end of this book, how do you want them to feel?
I want them to feel helped and I want them to feel hopeful that actually this book is a big, big message of hope that it is normal to struggle in your 20s. Let's not panic. Let's not pathologize. Let's not catastrophize. Let's problem solve and figure out what does it mean about the changes you need to make, the skills you need to build, what else you need to learn. But that in general, we know that life gets better as you go. If your 20s turn out to be the best years of your life, something has gone wrong. Life should get better, and it will. Yeah.
What about for those reading it that are parents of 20-somethings?
Similar message. I think that parents of 20-somethings will be relieved by reading the book to see that it's very normal for their kids or other kids to struggle, to see some of the trajectories around that people do get better over time, especially if they gain the skills that they need. I think it's also really important for parents not to panic or pathologize. I think a lot of parents are really quick to panic when their kids are having a hard time. It's very normal to struggle at work. It's very normal to be devastated by a breakup. It's very normal to have a lot of trouble making these big decisions that don't have right answers. That doesn't mean that there's something wrong with your child or that they're never going to feel better.
The third category, same question. How about the employers and managers of 20-somethings?
I would love for employers and managers to read this book because I'm a big proponent of work, that work is the single biggest driver of growth and change in young adults, more so than your relationships, more so than your past. So I think that not enough employers know what a steep learning curve so many young adults are on and how they're really contributing to their development in a very, very positive way.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to you, Dr. Meg Jay. You've written a book that I do think will be helpful and hopeful to all who read it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dana.
I'm Gianna Gelosi with your Fox True Crime Minute. The remains found at the bottom of a well in Mexico are the remains of two missing brothers from Australia and an American. Family members identified the remains of Jack and Callum Robinson and Jack Carter Road of San Diego. The three went missing last month on a surfing trip to Mexico's Baja Peninsula. Their tents and burned out truck were found along the coast. Thieves apparently killed the three to steal their truck because they wanted the tires. They then allegedly got rid of the bodies by dumping them in a 50-foot well near the coast. Brad Hess is a friend of the Robinson brothers.
I'm never going to go back down there. It's done for me. And I know a lot of the folks that I've talked to and in our network, they're done as well. And we live close. We're in San Diego.
A fourth body was found in the well, which had been there much longer. Police have taken two men and one woman into custody. There's more on the story at foxnews.com. Subscribe to the Fox True Crime Podcast with Emily Campagno. I'm Gianna Gelosi with your Fox True Crime Minute.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Scott Brown.
What's on your mind?
The nation recently marked Small Business Week, which has historically been a time to honor our nation's entrepreneurs. Yet the regulatory assault from the Biden administration has hardly been a cause for celebration. Having survived COVID-19, inflation, rising cost of energy, and widespread labor shortages, employers are facing increasing headwinds from their own federal government. In an economy where regulatory certainty is the key to growth, the Biden administration has brought anything but. Consider three events from the last week alone. First, the administration continued deflecting responsibility for lingering inflation onto private companies with their obsession over so-called junk fees, which are service charges imposed by private companies that the Biden administration deems to be unfair. Sure, no one likes paying unexpected costs, but consumers are also free to shop around on different platforms or apps. Furthermore, the administration is applying an overly broad one-size-fits-all mentality rather than specifically targeting certain industries. They're deploying a sledgehammer for a situation that calls for a scalpel. Second, the Federal Trade Commission issued a blanket rule of banning non-compete agreements, framed by FTC Chair Lina Khan and her followers as evil contracts that prevent workers from switching jobs in search of better employment opportunities. The reality is more complex. Non-competes are an essential tool to prevent corporate espionage and ensure that competition is fair, which ironically is a tentpole of the FTC mission statement, too often ignored by Khan in pursuit of her ideological crusade. Non-competes also allow businesses to protect their intellectual property and invest in training of their employees. It's no wonder that the FTC's unilateral ban already faces legal challenges and an uncertain future. Finally, Biden has promised to let the Trump-era tax cuts due to sunset at the end of next year expire. In other words, he will raise taxes on almost everyone, not just the wealthy and biggest corporations. According to the Tax Foundation, the 2017 tax cuts in the Jobs Act, TCJA, cuts across the board, including those at the bottom half of the tax bracket. The law not only lowered the marginal tax rates and widened tax brackets, but also expanded credits aimed at families, including the standard deductions and child tax credit, both of which are nearly doubled. By lowering their tax burden, the law has given small businesses the relief and flexibility to expand, pay higher wages, or prepare financially for the unknown. Meanwhile, the economic warning signs are blinking red. Gross domestic product missed the mark by a wide margin in the first quarter. Instead of the 2.4% increase anticipated by economists, GDP growth came in at only 1.6%. A Commerce Department report showed that inflation in the first quarter, as measured by Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, rose by 3.7%. The dreaded stagflation discussion has begun. The political numbers aren't much better for Biden. A poll from CNN found 70% of Americans believe economic conditions are poor. The president's approval rating for the economy is at 34%, and inflation, 29%, are underwater. Biden trails Trump by the largest margin of the race at the national level. Good policy leads to good politics. It's a lesson the Biden administration would be wise to heed. Unfortunately, from junk fees to non-compete to tax hikes, their recent actions do not offer much in the way of hope on either front, especially for small businesses. This is former U.S. Senator, U.S. Ambassador Scott Brown.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.